against the traditional Republican Party that we saw even like a decade ago, which was very traditionally conservative and stuff like that, right? So, yeah, obviously these things like shift all the time back and forth, which is why even like it's always interesting, but a bit of a trap, I think, to the original authors talk quite specifically and explicitly about particularly the American context of like right and left and where these values fall. But again, like that's problematic in and of itself, because we start to tend to think in that sort of like liberal conservative binary, when in reality, like, I actually agree that the way they've parsed this out as a descriptive model is relatively, like, it's quite interesting, and I think in many ways it's quite effective. But it's always gonna, we're always dealing with some, with a certain degree of like temporality when we're placing them, the values on a kind of the binary scale, because they're always going to be shifting and moving. And there's all sorts, especially like we were talking earlier specifically, you know, and I'm sure some of the listeners are thinking about like a Canadian context for theory of values. Well, to me, thinking about, as I was kind of trying to mull it over in my own head, the problem is that specifically a nation like Canada, which is very diverse and has, you know, kind of roots in liberal democracy and stuff like that, is it's very hard to pinpoint like what Canada necessarily is and where those values really fall, because there's such a high level of diversity, which is one of Canada's strengths, but it also could be argued as potentially one of the weaknesses as well, right? Versus like other more monolithic and unified cultural states, where you can see a considerably more like just like universal strand of political interests and values, right? Like we can think of especially about like smaller countries where you pretty much have like a very similar ethnic, religious, cultural diaspora, right?
And just to just to remind our listeners, you've been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. We are halfway through so far, and this has not gone the way I've expected. We are having a interesting discussion, but not the discussion that I was expecting, and I'm here for it. So we've gone over the main ideas of moral foundation theory, and now we're moving on to, I think, talking a little bit more about the Canadian context. So to bounce off of what Hale just bounce back off of what Hale just said, there's, well, the very obvious statement is that Canada as a country is probably, it's the second largest country in the world. It's very geographically, by physical size.
Yeah.
It is very geographically diverse.
Yeah.
So that creates very, I mean, I know this sounds really, really obvious, but where you live and what the environment is like where you live determines how you see the world. And that applies to the social context. It also applies to the physical context. If you live near the mountains and the streams and you go skiing every winter, and that's one experience. If you live on the flat plains and you never see a mountain and you never see a stream and you never see the ocean, that's a different experience. And it's how you think about the environment is going to be different, because your environment is different. So I think a lot of the regional differences in Canada come from the fact that people have different occupations and different environments where they live, and that shapes part of our identity. People have done some very good studies on people who live in mountains versus people who live on plains, and the cultural impacts of those on those societies just based off of geography. So I would say that that's definitely a huge component for sure.
I would say that it's becoming less of an issue, but yeah.
It definitely, as technology has progressed, we're definitely becoming a lot more of the same. I think the more we're able to communicate with each other, the more we're able to partake of the same types of things, the more similar people become in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, like, we're getting off track a little bit, but it kind of relates a little bit to what Brandon was saying earlier. I was kind of mulling this over, thinking about this, but yeah, obviously, like, geographic placement and thinking about like the value of, like, again, like sanctity, which is relating to like your and loyalty as well, like, you know, especially with particularly with loyalty, they spoke about how this, you know, this is about, it really relates to people's you know, close kinships in a lot of ways, right? Where you feel your loyalty rise in your personhood, who you identify with. And for a lot of people, that's much more of like a local basis. However, like obviously with the prevalence of like social media and stuff like that, that is like ballooning out. But it's certainly not unifying in the way that I think we years ago we expected it to kind of happen. And instead it's like it's people are basically shifting into like online bubbles of social political discourse or whatever, which would obviously overlap into the real world too in person, that are reflective already of the kind of loyalty biases and stuff that they already have, which is something that they talked a little bit about. The people are just going to naturally shift into. So if, let's say if I'm like from the mountains, right? Like you talked about different geographic settings, right? Say I, you know, I'm from rural Canada. I live in the Rockies, all that kind of stuff. You know, I'm getting online just like everyone else, but I'm going to find myself probably in a more like within online worlds, within political zones of discourse that reflect my conservative values already, right? And reinforce those things. I'm not suddenly going to get online and be on Reddit and be in some super like left wing sub being like, oh my gosh, I totally have had a revolution of my political values now, right? Like, it's or like people are just naturally shifting that way. What Brandon, you said something earlier about like we seek, you know, the Plato's like the political ship, right? And you want competency within the context of that. We seek out individuals who show some level of ability in whichever sort of situation, whether that be in society that they're in. I think though that politically we've entered a much weirder zone, for lack of a better way of putting it, where it's more about exposure than it is about competency, right? Like, and especially because societies have become so large, right? If who can get the most exposure or who has the most exposure, resources and stuff to begin with, right, is far more likely to get into a position of power and political influence than individuals who are just like really competent, right? Like there's almost like no competition. I can be really good at my job, but if everybody knows Aaron as being really good at the job, even if you're not, then like you're gonna be
voted for more.
You're gonna be voted for, yeah, right? Just like, and you're gonna have the influence and stuff behind you, yeah, right?
It's like the halo effect or mm-hmm. all those other things as well.
What I would like to see in the future of Canada is I'd like to see, and I'm just gonna throw out my random impossible ideas now. I'd like to see something like a national enterprise system where Canadians can coordinate with other Canadians across provincial lines in an easier way. Like, I feel like there's a lot of like American corporations where it's like they can operate in all of America and they know what that means. And there's more of a playbook to do that. Whereas in Canada, like if you're selling something in BC, what is the chance that you can actually get that product to market in Quebec easily and effectively? For most products, it's not efficient. It's not economical. It would be, I think, really nice if we could have more investments in regional or cross regional cooperation, because I think there's a lot of potential there, especially when it comes to Quebec. I know Quebec has ridiculously excellent science, especially, and they definitely have advantages when it comes to connections in France in terms of power infrastructure and transportation infrastructure. And the other day I was watching something that was about they've created a virtual reality program for ambulance drivers. So like those are the types of things which I think it would be great if other Canadians were interested in. But right now what I see as a major problem in Canada is it's like, if I say, look, you know, like there's this virtual reality program for training ambulance drivers from Quebec. Do we want to try it out? It's like, oh, well, we don't normally go to Quebec to look for how to do things in BC. We don't normally go to Nova Scotia to think about things BBC. We do things our own way because we're our own region. So yeah, I mean I'd like to see, I don't know, more cross-cultural cooperation between regions.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm just trying to think of like that doesn't seem to immediately, I mean I could think of like fairness where someone has something that they can, you know, they've got something of value and it's not unreasonable to go up to them and say like, hey, like this is really interesting, like we think that this could solve or address a particular problem that we're dealing with. But I think to more to the point of the intuitive ethics is that this should be like a more codified attitude within Canada, or more, it should be more obvious that reaching out, that seeing what others have to offer should be something that we resort to, rather than it being just serendipity that we find this stuff out. Because I think that is a good value.
As Kira brought up earlier, we have, and I think proportionality and equality are two major things that where you live in Canada, you are treated differently by your provincial government in a variety of different ways. So Canada has been working in some ways towards equal treatment of individuals and equal outcomes for individuals regardless of where they live in Canada, but that's certainly not a reality today. If you live in a centralized urban area like the Vancouver greater area or the Toronto greater area, you're going to have much better access to opportunities than, and somewhat better treatment depending on what area you're living, than a lot of other areas of the country. Although there's also the housing bubbles, so maybe it's not that simple.
Yeah, and I think too, it's like getting back to the theory of values itself is it's always so, like, you have the researchers that we're like discussing here in their system, which again I want to say is, I think in many ways is actually quite interesting. However, like, they're looking at like a descriptive system, right? Yep. Obviously not normative, as we've said before. The problem, though, I think in talking about this at times is that even how we kind of mentioned earlier, like how this sort of information is drummed up and how we come to these descriptions is an important discussion. But it's also like, if we want to talk about, okay, well, is Canada this way or should it be this way, or what values should we have and how should we set this up with the context of theirs? If the political system that you exist within, like, only effectively at a lot of times virtue signals those sort of those values, then you run into like a problem of more of like structural issues rather than like the discussion of like the values themselves, right? Maybe I'm not doing it like a super great job of explaining that, but it's basically like, look, if you have a political system that incentivizes success for politicians and incentivizes a sort of closed world of business and all that kind of stuff, then the values effectively become, and these sorts of discussions around what's important for Canadians, blah, 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 effectively becomes more of a propaganda exercise for the state rather than how things actually operate. Like, you kind of brought up a good example of this when you're thinking about like, oh, well, why don't we, like, Quebec has some really interesting technology, why are we not utilizing that technology, blah, blah, blah. Well, the answer would most likely relate back to, almost certainly would relate back to money, right, in some sort of way, right? Like, it's not like, you know, if Quebec does have these awesome opportunities, why are businesses that are involved not participating in those opportunities? Would it be because, one, those sorts of enterprises don't exist because they're not considered to be actually like financially viable, right? So they're considered to be operating at a loss. So whether it's the state or independent companies don't want to operate them, or is it like these businesses already have their connections and interests and investments that they're trying to actively protect, even if like it's not actually the best situation for the rest of Canada, but they're going to operate that way simply because like they have their own interests that are, again, generally rooted around like financial interests and power.
I think it's also, there's this really tough line of when it comes to things like provincial healthcare, there's a really fine line between conflict of interest and looking out for the best needs of your constituents. Like, if, for instance, if BC, the province where I currently live, wanted to adopt particular aspects of, let's make this really controversial, let's say that they wanted to adopt particular aspects of Alberta's healthcare system as something that's provincially regulated, the province of BC has the right to make whatever decisions it wants about its own healthcare. If it thinks it can do that through a better model that is similar to another province's model, it can do that. But as a matter of pride, why would BC want to do that unless it was very, very proven that it was good? And I think the same would be true if we flipped it the other way. Whereas if there was something that was very, very effective in BC, what would it take for that to translate to Alberta? I think there's some friction there. Maybe, and I think that honestly comes from a sense of honor. Like, there's a sense of honor in terms of, like, we can't, you know, like, look over the border and just see what we're, like, they're different people. They're different than us. What works for them is different because they live in a different place and things are different for them. And we can't necessarily know that if we take something from them that it would apply to us and work for us. And I think that's actually pretty fair, but there's also other parts to it.
Well, and I think that relates back to what they're talking about. You brought up honor. I also think about, like, the idea of loyalty, and you could see how you could also bring in sanctity in these sorts of discussions. But it's like, you know, there's a lot of, in our, like, current political social climate, there's a lot of talk of inter, like, not, sorry, I was going to say international, but I mean inside a state, not international in terms of, like, different nations, but internal, like, fracture, right? And between different areas and people living different lifestyles and whatever that kind of be. And I think it's like, you know, we have this tendency to think in this very, like, kind of still almost kind of nationalist way. Like, people are like, I think of myself as Canadian, or I think of myself as American, or whatever. But I think especially within, actually, in many ways, the current media trends really push other aspects of people's moral lives to be more important to them than something like a national ideal, right? And that might be something like regional, right? Like, people, so many people, especially online, like, identify with the Pacific Northwest, right? Like, that's where we live, that's where we're putting. It is, like, a lifestyle, it's a look, it's a set of values, all this kind of stuff. And that's quite distant and separate from any particular national identity, right? And you can see that all over the place with all sorts of different locational identities, but also another big one would be, like, gender and sexual identity type things. These are social groups that require a high degree of loyalty from participants, a high degree of sanctity, and a high degree of, like, frankly, like you said, honor. Like, there's a high degree of pride in all of these things as well that can be easily divorced from any sort of national identity, right? So, which then makes operating a more, like, traditional nation state, like, liberal democratic nation state probably more difficult, really. Like we have this thing. Yeah, you know, I remember growing up, we always talked about, you know, our diversity is our strength and blah, blah, blah. And there is, like, some legitimacy to that. But there's also a point in which people just completely stop associating with their national identity, right? And, like, and that is not good for national cohesion and, like, state functioning.
Well, I mean, there are some very specific historical events that have tied Canada together as a nation. There's, like, the construction of the railroad across the country. That was really, really, really big. There's, well, obviously the Second World War was very, very big in terms of bringing us together as a country. Yeah, it's, I think that, I don't know if you built another railroad, if that would really fix all of Canada's geographical, I mean, like, we're already connected. We wouldn't become that much more connected. So I think it would come down more to the federal government has to have something of value that BC especially would get by participating in it. And I'm not sure what that would look like, but it kind of has to, on the same type of thing though, it has to be something they can kind of equally offer to all of the provinces so they can all have participate in that value. And I think you're actually really correct here that this does make Canada as a nation harder to govern, because you have to set a policy that is fair to the provinces in some sense, but also is adaptable to their specific needs. And the provinces have very different needs. Anyway, this has gone way too far into the Canadian politics side of things. Okay.
But I think, like, I was trying to think about how to articulate this, and I don't know if you, like, any more of what I'm trying to say, but it's like,
yeah, what are you trying to say?
They're, like, you're still talking in terms of these sorts of the values in relationship to like the state and the population's relationship.
I think my main thing with the show, and I'm only realizing this now, is that I don't really have a language for talking about the issues that we're dealing with as Canadians.
Yeah.
And I can see some of the language from this moral foundation theory as being helpful, as getting us on a page where we can at least talk a little bit
about it. The moral foundation theory also explains why people are, or not explains, but can be descriptive of why people are continuing to disassociate from the state, right? And that's what I would say is more prevalent. And on some level, I'm taking this anecdotally, so our listeners can, if they choose to scoff off what I'm saying, that's completely fine. But it would seem to me that it seemed like the Canadian identity that people commit to, right, that is not as much the placement of loyalty as a moral value, as a fundamental moral value, and then that those sorts of things are being found in other aspects of social cohesion and interest that people primarily participate with online in a lot of ways, right? And that's the kind of weird thing about today, right? Like, just so many people. People don't seem to be quite as proud as being Canadian, but they're certainly proud of other aspects of their social and personal identity, and they're more than willing to get very uppity and defend those things if they think they're under attack, whether they be right or left or whatever that placement might be. But that presents very serious issues for the state, right? If people aren't interested.
Well, right. to push back on that pretty hard, like I recently went to Remembrance Day in Victoria, and I can tell you there are a lot of Canadians that have very strong loyalty to this country and have huge respect for our traditions of this country. It might not be the majority of people, but it's a strong foundation of people. Well, it's not just the institutions. It's the people who believe in those institutions, maintain those institutions, fight and die for those institutions.
Yeah, those are social institutions insofar as they're composed of people who...
Yep.
carry those values by enacting them in that way.
I mean, yeah, but I wouldn't say that the Remembrance Day isn't about the military institution.
No. I think you're getting hung up on the word institution. Yep. The people who I would say that is an institution. The people who have loyalty and enact that loyalty in that way.
There are different communities in Canada that have different needs and objectives.
Yeah,
and one of them is the patriotic one.
Yeah, and when you can find them in, they seem to be kind of fragmented in certain areas of Canadian society, like online, but then they seem to be quite strong in other areas, such as national recognition of veterans and whatnot. I'm curious about this, so, because I know I understand we're coming to the end of the show. I wonder if there's a way that we can get some language around that, if there's a way that we have kind of drawn out some of the facts that we might be able to point to and name to give language to this. It's kind of a descriptive roadmap for the way that an intuitive morality is constructed. And you can take it and you can go to any moral society and see how it interacts with these. Again, some might not even have any of them at all. None of them are universal or necessary, but the way that we've been looking at Canadian society and the way that it has interacted with this general blueprint of like a psychological moral society, the way that we've been seeing some of the ways that it's emphasized certain things and some of the ways that it's either skewed or distorted or has, you know, certain aspects absent to it, are there any particular facets of those descriptions that we've gone over that we can name? I'm trying to think of some in particular.
Because we have a constitution, mm-hmm. which is very durable and enduring, we have a very specific relationship with authority. That's kind of more or less set in stone. Loyalty is probably on the lower end of things it's still important to Canadians. We have a national identity, but it's not the thing that's most important for many people. Care versus harm is really, really important in Canada today, making sure that people are properly cared for and that people are not allowed to harm other people. That's a really big thing in our political discourse. Equality is also important. Again, the relationships between the provinces. Proportionality is, I would say, like, I mean, we've been suffering from like wage stagnation for like 30 to 40 years. So there's a lot of people who are doing the same job and getting a lot less for it. And so that's definitely, Kira brought up, liberty. That's definitely a big part of who we are as Canadians. We have, you know, the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. That is something that, Canadians do not like the idea of domination. I think that's very true in general.
Which is maybe where like this theory is helpful though, right? Because if you look at like, you know, a universal moral truth, like it's very dictative, you know, and very virtue based and in principles of shaming and judging, and where this theory seems to be a lot more about empathy and understanding and using intuition, and I'm not sure about reason. That's the only thing that's kind of a little scary about this one in a philosophical perspective, just for myself. But other than that, like it's a great alternative to try and open up a conversation within a country to at least, like you say, like get
some clarity without
it being so dichotomous. Yeah.
Yeah, because it's nice to know the important things about participating in your society, and that we can all be on the same page on that. Also, like I didn't say fairness. Like that, I think that's also pretty obvious in Canada. Purity, I don't honestly think that I have a good idea of what's going on there, so I'm gonna skip that. And yeah, that's probably my that's gone through most of the list. Honor and ownership. Ownership too long to discuss. There's an ongoing it's discussion in terms of Canada and Indigenous peoples, in terms of economic reconciliation. But in general, I think Canadians are in favor of ownership, in favor of the benefits of that, but they also understand that there are some problems with that as well. All right, I think for the sake of time, we are going to end our show there. Thank you so much to Kira Tiannan, Hale Rottery, and Brandon Brownlee. And I've been Aaron Wang, and this has been the Canadian Philosophy Show. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you tune in next time.
Email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca. You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
You are listening to CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples.
This is Bird Note. Some birds are much more efficient flyers than others. They get more power out of each flap of the wing. Birds that capture their food with their beaks while in flight are the best flyers of all. But there's a trade-off. Feet have many uses, but for a flying bird, they're a drag, literally. So birds that pursue prey on the wing have evolved weaker feet than other birds. Just like with airplanes and rockets, reducing the weight of anything not needed for propulsion increases flight efficiency. Both swallows, which snatch flying insects out of the air, and hummingbirds, which catch their prey and gather nectar in flight, have weak feet. They can perch, but they can't walk. And swifts, the birds most highly adapted for flight, have such weak feet that they can't even perch. They can only hang by their long claws or shuffle a few inches. But in return, swifts can fly rapidly and efficiently, and they have great maneuverability. They and their close relatives, those hummingbirds, are the only birds that can fly straight up. That enables the swifts to exit chimneys and cavities in trees where they nest. Now that's an efficient flyer. For BirdNote, I'm Mary McCann.